Hello, welcome to Antiquitas, Leaders and Legends of the Ancient World, with Cornell University professor Barry Strauss, military historian, expert in the ancient world, and best-selling author. During this podcast, Barry and his guests will share stories about fascinating and controversial people and events in history and myth. And now, Professor Barry Strauss.
Welcome to the second season of Antiquitas. Our subject this season is the death of Caesar. And we're going to begin today with an episode on Caesar and Cleopatra. It was autumn, 48 BC. The place was Alexandria, the beautiful and elegant capital city of Egypt, a place that's been called the Paris of the ancient world. We're in the royal palace, standing beside two people. He was 52 years old, tall, thin, imposing, with flashing dark eyes. She was 21. She was not classically beautiful, but she had a charm and conversational ability that was beyond compare. The two of them were probably among the most intelligent people in the ancient world. Their souls were brilliant, restless, active, ambitious, violent, and ruthless. He was Julius Caesar, dictator of Rome. She was Cleopatra, joint monarch of Egypt with her brother, who was in the process of trying to drive her from the throne. Caesar and Cleopatra soon became both political allies and lovers. Their meeting has often been seen as a turning point in their two careers. For Cleopatra, it meant victory in her war with her younger brother, with whom she was sharing the throne of Egypt. She was queen, he was king. For Caesar, it marked yet another step on the road leading to royal or near-royal ambition in Rome. For both, it meant the conception of a child, the future Ptolemy XV, known as Caesarion, literally Little Caesar. Cleopatra claimed the son was Caesar's, and Caesar never denied it. In fact, he continued the liaison with Cleopatra, and eventually she became pregnant again. Born in 69 BC, Cleopatra was one of several children of King Ptolemy XII of Egypt. The Ptolemies were descended from a marshal of Alexander the Great, and they had ruled Egypt for 150 years. Egypt was worth ruling because its agricultural fertility made it one of the richest countries, if not the richest country, of the ancient Mediterranean. At their height, the Ptolemies made Egypt a great power. By the mid-first century BC, though, they were much weaker, and they stood in the shadow of Rome. Rome had conquered every other important state in the Mediterranean. The only reason for sparing Egypt was an internal political reason. Rome's quarreling generals didn't want any one of them to control that country's wealth, and so they preferred to leave Egypt independent. Now, Ptolemy XII, Cleopatra's father, shrewdly played a game of appeasing Rome, and he often had to swallow his pride. No wonder he had the vaguely insulting nickname of the flute player. His daughter, Cleopatra, was every bit her father's equal in shrewdness. She added a wrinkle to his policies, though, by connecting herself to her Roman allies via love affairs and by having children by them, first by Caesar and later, after Caesar's death, by Mark Antony. Caesar was born in 100 BC, and he was as talented, determined, cold-blooded, and lascivious a public figure as the Roman Republic ever produced. Born into the nobility, he thirsted for military and political success and achieved both. He was Rome's leading populist politician and its greatest general. His most impressive military feat was conquering Gaul, roughly today's France and Belgium, as well as parts of the Netherlands and Germany, in the 50s BC, as well as invading Britain, which seemed as remote from Rome then as another solar system does to us today. His political enemies decided to bring Caesar down. He responded by going to war, a civil war. In August 48 BC, Caesar defeated his leading rival, Pompey the Great, at a battle in central Greece. Pompey fled to Egypt, where he had allies, but they betrayed him and murdered him. When Caesar, in turn, arrived in Egypt in hot pursuit, they presented him with Pompey's severed head. But Caesar knew that his civil war was not over. His enemies still had huge resources, and they were regrouping in what is now Tunisia. Caesar needed Cleopatra for her wealth. Cleopatra needed Caesar for his muscle, that is, for the political and military support to keep her brother from driving her from power. The two of them formed an alliance. After a tough fight in which he was outnumbered, Caesar prevailed. He defeated Cleopatra's enemies. Her brother died in the fighting. Afterwards, Caesar stayed in Egypt for several months. He went on a cruise down the Nile with Cleopatra. He stayed in Egypt much longer than he had to. Why? Is it possible that he was in love with the young Egyptian queen? It's really impossible not to be fascinated by the relationship between Caesar and Cleopatra, who were two of the leading figures of the age. Yet it is all too easy to misinterpret it. Cleopatra is usually remembered as a sex object, a loose woman who manipulated men and tried to conquer Rome. Blame Hollywood and Shakespeare! The Bard's Antony and Cleopatra is based on the queen's later relationship with another powerful Roman, Mark Antony. But the real Cleopatra ruled Egypt for nearly 22 years. She was a major statesman, a brilliant administrator, politician, strategist, and diplomat. She was no less impressive a figure as a ruler than was England's Elizabeth I or Russia's Catherine the Great. Yet we think of Cleopatra as Elizabeth Taylor. How do we get things so wrong? Well, to discuss this matter, I'm talking to my Cornell colleague, Professor Derba Ghosh, who is a historian of gender and colonialism with a focus on South Asia. She's also director of Cornell's program in feminist, gender, and sexuality studies. She's the author of Sex and the Family in Colonial India, which was featured in the BBC documentary Love and Betrayal in Mughal India. Derba, thanks so much for being with me today.
Thank you for having me, Barry.
It's really great. I want to begin with a question. Is it difficult for us still today, in 2019, to imagine a woman as a ruler in her own right without reducing her to a sex object? And if so, why?
Absolutely. I think it's still very difficult to imagine without sexuality. Women are often only about their gender, while men are often seen as beyond sexuality. To put it another way, women are often seen to be the product of sex and their emotions, while we often presume that men are unaffected by emotions or sexuality. So, for instance, in the last presidential election, many voters saw the first female candidate as an unlikable woman, which became a way of focusing on her sexuality. Focusing on women as potential sex objects disables them from being powerful in their own right, which means that often women have to negotiate or manage their sexuality and their emotions, desires, and feelings in distinct ways. In the past, and I think Cleopatra's not an exception, women leaders had to pretend to manage their emotions and desires in a certain way in order to be taken seriously. What I think is really interesting right now, and I think it's so great you're doing this podcast and focusing on Cleopatra, is that we're seeing an avalanche of movies, TV series, biographies, and history books on powerful women. From Netflix's The Crown to Victoria on PBS and the recent film on Mary, Queen of Scots, we seem to be obsessed with how queens can govern given what is conventionally called their proclivity to quote-unquote passions or sentiment, terms that we know from the Renaissance to the Romantics.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I'm fascinated by those series myself. I'm totally addicted to The Crown. In fact, I think I've seen most of the episodes not just twice, but three times. And it's really amazing the degree to which we're fascinated by politics when it's a family drama.
Yeah, well, and what's interesting about The Crown, right, is that a lot of, or at least the first two seasons, have focused on the relationship between Queen Elizabeth and Prince Philip.
Yeah.
And actually, Victoria is not any different, mm-hmm. where you have these princes who have been brought in to marry these queens. There clearly is love and affection and romance there. And yet both of these princes, at least in these media depictions, are disaffected, right? They feel that they are of lower status than the women that they're married to. And this is an important part of the negotiation that we see Victoria going through in the 19th century and Elizabeth in the 20th.
Yeah, I know. It's really interesting. And clearly, I'm going to have to add Victoria to my watch list. It sounds great. With Caesar and Cleopatra, it might have been a little bit different since Caesar was a powerful person in his own right. And yet, when he was in Egypt, he was on Cleopatra's terrain. So it would have been really interesting to negotiate the relationship. Cleopatra was the ruler. She was also a goddess in Egypt. And really interesting to wonder how Caesar reacted to that and what it meant to him. Did he negotiate it more successfully than Prince Philip and the crown, does?
Yeah, I think that's what's so unique about Caesar and Cleopatra is that they are both powerful in their own right,
yeah.
Right? And Caesar, by the time he arrives in Egypt, has already got a trail of successes to show for his authority. So in some ways, you can see why they would have been attracted to one another. She was this young queen who was obviously very savvy.
Yeah.
He was already quite a decorated figure.
Yes.
And from your account in the book, mm-hmm. it seems like he was both very, very strategic, but also a great military hero. And I can imagine that for the two of them, what this was an affair between equals, which would have been very hard for Cleopatra anywhere else, right?
Yeah.
It would have been hard to imagine Cleopatra finding an equal.
Yeah, that's really interesting. In her novel about Caesar and Cleopatra, Colleen McCullough says that Cleopatra decides that Caesar's really the only person worthy of her to produce an heir by, and that's one of the reasons she's so attracted to Caesar. Who knows? Maybe it's true.
Well, but it's a problem for powerful women, right?
Yeah.
It's very hard to marry down
mm-hmm.
if you're a powerful woman.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that that's the choice that Cleopatra was facing.
Yeah, yeah. She also, of course, had to, as the queen, she had to worry about Egypt's future. And Egypt's future in large part depended on its relationship with Rome. And Caesar was not just a really impressive person, but he was also the representative of Rome, locked in a civil war, so not guaranteed to win.
Right.
And in allying with him, Cleopatra was taking a bet on how the civil war was going to turn out. But she had to think, you know, what's my best move? What's the best way to protect Egypt in my dynasty in this all-important relationship with Rome?
Yeah, well, and it's a very clever choice,
yeah,
right, in
absolutely.
Some ways. I mean, I think that one of the things that's very interesting is that she can be a very salutary figure for women leaders. But one of the things that's quite interesting is that she clearly figured out that disarming men was central if she was going to claim the mantle of leadership that was on offer. We can't forget about her brother, right?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Her brother is an important figure. It's an issue, though, for some feminist scholars, right? Is Cleopatra resisting patriarchy? Probably not.
Mm-hmm.
Was she manipulative in using her feminine charms? We can easily imagine that possibility, and certainly
right.
the Elizabeth Taylor example
yeah.
Offers us that. But she's also very strategic, and what she probably knew was that giving birth to Caesar's heir was an important part of her political power.
Yeah.
And it's not surprising in some ways that she then marries Mark Antony, has several more children as a way of extending her influence. What's really interesting about her is widows typically don't have a good time in history,
right.
And older women certainly don't.
Right.
Right. And Cleopatra seems to really outlive her youth in a productive way. One way to say this is because she's a woman, she can behave in ways that male leaders can't,
mm-hmm.
i.e. she can bear children.
Right.
If we could imagine a scenario in which Caesar seduced Cleopatra's brother.
Right.
Right, which I gave you as a kind of queer counterfactual.
Yeah, interesting one.
You know, that would not have the same political outcome, yeah. Right? They have an heir.
Right.
The heir then goes on to become the king of Egypt.
Right.
It's hard to imagine that Cleopatra didn't think of that.
No, I'm sure she did. I mean, she was very intelligent and very strategic. So I'm sure she was thinking about that.
Yeah. And if you've seen, I know some of your listeners will have seen the Mary Queen of Scots film.
Yeah.
And what's interesting is there, too, Mary Queen of Scots makes a calculation, at least in the film, that having an heir is the way that she can secure Scotland.
Yeah, I mean, I've only seen the trailer, but I really want to see the movie. It looks fascinating because it really is a really interesting comparative case for Caesar and Cleopatra. The politics of having an heir are enormously important. And as we'll talk about in a minute, they have reverberations in Rome as well. When Caesar's only living child is the heir to the throne of Egypt. What does that mean in Rome? But before talking about that, I wanted to ask you about the question of whether we think Caesar and Cleopatra were in love, you know? And in my experience, and honestly, I'm guilty of this myself, the default mode for historians is saying, oh, come on, love. What's love got to do with it? These are power brokers, and this is strictly a power relationship with Caesar and Cleopatra each using the other. But what if we take a step back and say, and ask, were they in love? Is it possible that they were in love?
Well, it's possible, right?
Yeah.
But I think I'd refer to a previous podcast of yours in this mm-hmm. series, Barry, where you said that in part this is about how we tell the history or yeah. the story of this.
Right.
And I think the history of love, or rather a subfield within history, the history of emotions, is one way to respond to the what's love got to do with it
right.
question. In terms of comprehending what happened between Caesar and Cleopatra, the cultural, social, political expectations for each of them likely framed how they responded to the other. So I think what a historian of emotion would say is, rather than think of love as this universal feeling,
mm-hmm.
what's likely is that they could see what circumstances they were in. And for Cleopatra, it was that she would struggle to find a political and social equal as Caesar.
Right.
And, you know, you made the point about him staying on longer than he needed to.
Right.
I suspect maybe he was a certain kind of feminist leader where it would be hard for him to find a woman that was his equal. Right?
I think that's true. Yeah.
And so I think one of the things that's clear is that theirs is a relationship that is unusual because it has these important historical consequences.
Right.
They have a son who goes on to become the king of Egypt. It's a way of extending Caesar's orbit
mm-hmm.
in a variety of ways. I think for me as a historian of sexuality, the fact that the love story between Cleopatra and Caesar has been narrated in so many different ways, in so many different moments, as you say, from Shakespeare to Elizabeth Taylor, suggests that the history of love and emotions is often central to how we understand politics. So if she bore him a child so she could have an heir, their relationship accomplished a great deal politically. It meant that he could claim Egypt, a place that he clearly admired, and she edged out her rivals, including her brother,
yeah.
who noticeably couldn't have an heir
right.
with Caesar, right?
Right? Yes.
So the story of her, but what I would say about her is that calculating a pregnancy would get her out of being territorially conquered, right?
Yeah.
It's a way of her evading the problem that a lot of women leaders have is that mm-hmm. they're seen not to be tough enough,
right? Yeah.
But it also seems cold-blooded, right?
Yes.
And so I think the love story makes her a likable historical figure,
mm-hmm.
at least in some version of that
right.
story, right?
Yeah.
We
yeah.
can like her a little bit more if we think she was in love and this was a child of love.
Yeah. We can. That's just really interesting. I think we can like Caesar a little bit more as well because he's such a calculating person. We can like him a little bit more, too, if we think, you know, yeah, he calculated with Cleopatra, but maybe also he fell for her. Maybe.
Well, I agree with you. I think it does make Caesar quite a lot more likable, yeah. right?
Yeah.
It makes him less predatory, certainly.
Yes.
Right? If this was a relationship that was consensual and companionate.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And, of course, we don't know and can never know. We don't have either one of their voices telling the story. Caesar all but leaves Cleopatra out of his version of the Roman Civil War. We don't have Cleopatra's version. Almost everything we know about her from the literary sources is hostile, written after she's defeated and dead, written by the hostile victors. We do have some inscriptions and some art that give us a slightly different picture and that allow us to see that she was a really strong and competent ruler, simply as a manager, as an administrator. She was terrific. And we don't get that from the literary sources, but we can't look into her emotions. And I don't have to tell you, it's difficult in general to look in people's emotions historically.
Yeah, I think it's hard to know what each of them thought, but it's quite striking that the characterization of this as a love story accomplishes a lot for the history of this period.
What do you mean?
Well, it explains the heir.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
It explains that this wasn't a conquest in a traditional way.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
It evades the problem that Caesar's generals have uh-huh. before about how to split up Egypt, right?
Right, yeah.
You don't actually have to split it up if you have a relationship with its queen.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
So it resolves a lot of political problems,
yes.
is the way I would say it.
Yeah, really interesting. Thanks. So let me move on a little bit to how this reverberated in Rome, and then I want to ask you about that as well. So I think Caesar was impressed by Alexandria, as all Romans who went to Alexandria were. We think of Rome today as this great marble city, but in Caesar's day, it was still pretty unimpressive, pretty austere, in some sense, to be anachronistic, Puritan. It was a city of brick. And when Caesar got back to Rome, he wanted to rebuild it as a glittering world capital. And clearly, Alexandria was one of the things that impressed him. That much is uncontroversial. More controversial is whether Caesar's relationship with Cleopatra had an impact on his political evolution. Caesar, before meeting Cleopatra, had pushed to the top of Roman politics and gone on to conquer Gaul. And in Gaul, he was treated as almost a king by the people there. He had already had temporary positions as dictator of Rome. But when he came back to Rome, he seems to be moving in an even more monarchical direction. Eventually, a few years after meeting Cleopatra, he takes the title of Dictator in Perpetuity, a title that had never existed before in Rome. And where did he get this idea from? It's surely part of a response to all his experiences in life, but was one of those experiences his relationship with Cleopatra? Did their love affair convince him that he should be a king? And if we go down that route, how do we make sure that we're not blaming things on Cleopatra? How do we make sure that we're not portraying her as a manipulator who bewitched Caesar? Is there any way to navigate these waters and to think about what the influence of his experiences with the Queen of Egypt might have been?
I think it's so possible to imagine that love changed Caesar. When you started, what I found quite striking in the story was that he was in his 50s when they met.
Yeah.
So I think for those of us who are in our 50s, we know that we're facing middle age, right? She was in her 20s.
Yeah.
I can imagine, and then they have a child, right?
Yeah.
I can imagine their affair gave him political possibilities in Egypt. It's hard not to imagine that the relationship gave him some energy and some initiative when he returned to Rome. I wouldn't be surprised if what he felt was a successful trip to Egypt then translated him to him feeling that he had a right to return to Rome and declare himself dictator for life.
I agree. I mean, we can only speculate. And I must point out that Caesar was a womanizer and he wasn't faithful to Cleopatra. But that doesn't mean that she didn't have a big impression on him and that it didn't have a big impact. It's a fascinating question. To look at it from a different point of view, it's clear that Caesar's political opponents in Rome also thought that Cleopatra had played a big role and not a good one. As we all know, Caesar becomes very controversial. His opponents see him as a threat to Roman liberty. They want Rome to remain a republic. They see him as somebody who, though he denies it, really wants to become a king. And the result, as we all know, was the murder of Caesar in the Roman Senate on March 15th, 44 BC, the Ides of March. We all know this from Shakespeare and the movies, etc. But what few of us know is that at the time, on the Ides of March, Cleopatra was not in Egypt, she was in Rome. And she was living in the suburbs in a luxurious villa that belonged to who else? It belonged to Caesar. And elite Romans, such as Cicero, resented her presence. He said in one of his letters, he's really blunt, "I hate the queen." You don't get any blunter than that. Did he hate her because she was a woman? Because she was a foreigner, because she didn't favor him. She had promised him some books, which apparently she didn't deliver. Did she hate him because, as this has been suggested, that because she was simply smarter than him? Or did he and others look at Cleopatra? And one of the ancient sources claims this is the case. They looked at Cleopatra and they said, whoa, if Caesar is involved with a queen, how can we not think that he wants to become a king? Especially because he's had a child by her, and as it turns out, she's pregnant at the time of his death. Now, she loses the child, either through miscarriage or stillbirth. We don't know the circumstance. So she only has one child by Caesar. But do people look at this and say, you know, we really want to get, really don't trust Caesar, and it's because of Cleopatra?
You know, women being ambitious or yoking themselves to ambitious men is always a problem in historical terms. And one of the reasons is because it offers the possibility that historical change happened because of a woman's actions. So one of the things that I think is very interesting about what you said is that she's a queen and Caesar's opponents imagine a republican form of governance, right?
Yeah.
And so this is in some ways a worry that's about politics that is then feminized into the fact that she's a queen, right?
Yeah.
That's one of the problems, I think, for mainstream history is that we often focus on men as the key historical factors.
Right.
And that argument actually focuses on her status as a queen, which is quite interesting.
Yeah.
Right? If we want to believe the story about Caesar as a great leader and strategist, then blaming Cleopatra works very well to sustain the idea that he betrayed these republican ideals.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
And that her presence there was a form of betrayal, right, of him, which led to his assassination. So it's not surprising that she's seen as the reason that the assassination occurs. But if we were to see his assassination as a political act, one that challenged his claim to being dictator for life, then unless you demonize Cleopatra, she doesn't play a whole lot of part in the story,
right?
Yeah. And I think it gets back to your first question, which is, are women always sexual objects,
yes.
Right?
Yeah.
And in some ways, the answer here is probably yes, right? That you may decide that she's a queen,
right?
And you can't approve of this relationship.
Right.
Right? On the other hand, she is a queen, and so you demonize her as a woman.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
And so I think it's a way in which her gender is a way of separating out her political impact, right, or diminishing her political impact. And I think in that sense, the way that the story is told is really important, right? When Cicero says, "I hate the queen."
Yeah.
He may hate her because he doesn't think she's attractive or she's leading Caesar down the wrong path.
Right.
But it seems like at some level he might just hate her because she represents this form of government that he doesn't think is right for Rome.
No, I think that's a really good point. It's difficult to separate the two sides out, that she's a woman with a great deal of influence, but also that she's a queen, that she's royalty, and she represents Caesar's flirtation with royalty and maybe more than flirtation, because Rome's at a very difficult point historically. The Republic's been in a lot of trouble for generations. And is the Republic going to survive, or is it going to become some sort of monarchy? Yeah. And so I think that this really crystallizes that question.
Yeah. I was going to also say, I mean, Caesar being a womanizer,
yeah,
most of these guys are womanizers, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm thinking of the Mughal emperors or the yeah. Ottoman emperors
yes.
who have harems,
yes.
right? And there the contest is always over which of the women in these harems or among the women that the powerful emperor is sleeping with, which of these women is going to rise to the top?
Yeah.
Right? And
right.
Cleopatra is already on top
yes.
in some ways.
Yes. Caesar, by the way, has a wife, a lawful wife in yeah. Rome, who
yeah.
he's living with at the time that Cleopatra's there. He's living with his wife, Calpurnia,
right.
who
yeah.
is she comes from the absolute superstar political class of Rome. Her father's one of the leading politicians in Rome, and Caesar married her for political reasons. She's no pushover, though. She is also a tough lady, and she's living with Caesar in their house on the edge of the Roman Forum, while a mile away, Caesar's mistress, and possibly Caesar's illegitimate son, we don't know, are living as well. So it's a bit of a harem, and
yeah.
there are many other women in Rome who've slept with Caesar, most famously the mother of Caesar's leading assassin, Brutus, Servilia. Mm. So, yeah,
yeah.
The Ottoman and Mughal examples are good ones.
Well, it sounds like they were set up for a succession battle
yeah.
that had to do with family.
They were set up for a succession battle that has to do with family, and you can tell the story of this period as a family drama. I think that's one of the reasons it's so interesting to us and why you get things like, to go back to an earlier TV series, I, Claudius.
Oh, right. yes. yeah, that's right.
Where the story of the early emperors beginning with Augustus and Livia is a family story.
And, right.
You know, I think we might get a misleading view about the Romans, and I'm sorry for causing the misimpression of the severe manly republic versus the feminine queen of Egypt.
Mm-hmm.
Because in Roman politics, Roman politics was dominated by aristocratic houses, and in many, if not all of them, there were powerful women
mm-hmm.
who played important roles, sometimes usually behind the scenes, but sometimes not so behind the scenes. And we have lots of evidence of women elite women conducting political meetings. They'd call these meetings, and the men would meet, and the women would be running the meetings. Much less common, we see elite women recruiting armies.
Mm-hmm.
That's not an everyday event, but that does happen as well. So
that's interesting.
In Rome, there's no way that Rome is a gender egalitarian society. Absolutely the opposite. It's very patriarchal and very macho. And Egypt is also not egalitarian, but more egalitarian than Rome. But still, women, elite women, are playing really important and often powerful roles in Rome.
So can I ask you
yeah.
a question?
Yeah, sure.
What do you think the presence of Cleopatra would have done to the women that were in Rome then?
Oh, it's a great question, and it's a long story. And Cleopatra, so this is just the beginning of Cleopatra's influence in Rome. So Caesar's assassination is 44 BC. Cleopatra is a figure in Roman politics. She doesn't come back to Rome, but she's a figure in Roman politics for the next 14 years. And we can trace something. She's in the back of some people's minds, and sometimes in the front of some people's minds. She's a fashion icon, but the fashions are not simply fashions. They have to do with political power as well. We know that she sets a hairstyle that's really mm-hmm. influential on with people, and so influential that her political opponents come up with a counter hairstyle for Roman women. We know this is a whole politics of pearls. And that Cleopatra's pearls, which are very, very expensive pearls, become important props. Caesar, before even meeting Cleopatra, has bought a very expensive pearl for his mistress, Brutus's mother. So she is very important, and she also has big influence on Roman religion. And in Rome, religion is very political. There's no separation between church and state. So she's a tremendously important figure. Some have argued that she's the most important figure of the age. I'm not sure I'm willing to go that far, but I think she is tremendously important and should not be underestimated in any way. And as I said, her relationship with Caesar is just the beginning of the story.
That's fascinating. I mean, that is fascinating.
It is really fascinating. So I guess I wanted to ask you if you think there are some takeaways from the story for us today.
There are probably a lot of lessons to learn. I mean, I'll start by saying that I struggle to see a similar relationship in which the woman ruler had as much credibility or power as the man she married. Mm-hmm. So the quick and short answer probably to your question is no, it's hard to think of other examples. Mm-hmm. But I think as we've already talked a little bit about, the Mughal emperors are very well known for marrying strategically. Mm-hmm. They married early and often.
Right.
And like the Ottomans, the emperors were involved with a range of women. Range of women in terms of status, mm-hmm. so from courtly women to slave women. They also were well known for marrying women across the empire, so beyond their limited ethnic group. The women in the harem developed their own strategies for advancement, and a lot of this is based on who had borne a child or had custody over the heirs. Two Mughal relationships, I would say, stand out as having been about love and romance. The relationship between the Emperor Akbar and a Rajput princess, mm-hmm. Which some of your Bombay film watchers will know was made into film called Jodha Akbar. And the story there is that Akbar solidified his conquest over northern India mm-hmm. by marrying the princess of a Rajput household. Mm-hmm. And the Rajputs, of course, identified as Hindu, and Akbar developed his own religion, but is nominally almost always identified as Muslim. And so it's an example of Hindu-Muslim exchange or interaction.
Really interesting.
And the depictions of that household are that she was allowed to carry on her rituals as he carried on his. And so there, again, politics and religion merge. But again, it was a story about a kind of territorial relationship that's consolidated through marriage. And then their son becomes the next Mughal emperor. And it's a way, I mean, I think as a lot of historians would say, it's a way of indigenizing the Mughals who come from Central Asia to northern India.
Right.
It's a way of making them Indian, which I think is important.
Very interesting.
There's a recent biography that's come out of Nur Jahan, who's the who's a Persian noblewoman whose family was at the court of the Mughals, and she marries the Emperor Jahangir. And Jahangir kind of loses it at the end, is very ill and is mentally incapacitated, and she basically runs the empire for the last few years of his reign.
Very interesting.
And so we do have, you know, quite a few stories of these quite powerful women emerging as leaders in their own right. They are often spoken of, I think, as exceptions. It's not clear to me that they were that exceptional, actually. But I think, as you say, these were patriarchal societies in which it would have been hard to admit that the woman was running the show. And so I think the story, particularly of Nur Jahan, has become of a woman who was exceptionally savvy, exceptionally strategic, politically quite canny, and so on. But again, what's very interesting about both of those stories, and also maybe a parallel to Cleopatra, is that these are women whose territories matter a lot to the empire.
Yeah.
Right? And in a kind of quite striking way, it's a way in which you can amass territory without necessarily the specter of warfare and violence, right? So which makes integrating those territories smoother, I guess.
Yeah.
You know, so if you have a love story between Akbar and a Rajput princess,
yes,
that goes a lot better for everybody.
Yes.
Than a violent,
yes,
kind of military conquest.
Really interesting. Yeah. No, and it's very helpful in the comparative point of view, suggesting what might have happened had Caesar lived, and had he and Cleopatra been able to raise Caesarion to adulthood, and how different the Roman relationship with Egypt might have been.
Right. But it sounds like his opponents really didn't want that.
Oh, no, they didn't. Well, Durba, thank you. This has been a really real privilege. It's just been a fascinating conversation. I've learned so much, and I'm sure our listeners will have that same feeling as well.
Well, thank you so much for having me on the podcast. It's been a great series so far.
Oh, thank you.
And I look forward to the second season.
Thank you so much. If you're interested in the subject and you want to learn more about it and more about the assassination of Julius Caesar, then I will shamelessly advertise my own book, The Death of Caesar, The Story of History's Most Famous Assassination, published by Simon & Schuster, and that goes into the subject in more detail. And you can read about that story. You can read about what happened to Antony and Octavius in my new book, 10 Caesars, Roman Emperors from Augustus to Constantine. This book will be available on March 5th wherever books are sold, and I promise you it takes the story from after Caesar's assassination, through the career of Octavius, and through the career of the Roman Empire that he founds, because Gaius Octavius was none other than the man who would one day become Augustus, the first Roman emperor. But that's another story. Meanwhile, I hope you will join us again next time when I'm going to be introducing you to Caesar's assassins. See you soon.
Theme music by Lush Life.